Well, it is 7, so we can go ahead and get started. Thanks everyone for joining us today. I'm Scott Schiff, hosting the Atlas Society Senior Fellow Rob Trzynski, doing an Ask Me Anything. We've got lots of quest channels, but we want to encourage live questions. So as Rob is answering these, if you want to join us, just raise your hand and we'll bring you up on stage. Rob, thanks for being here. I'm not even going to get into the Mises Caucus stuff. I follow your writing, but I do have to at least ask you a little bit about the piece you wrote in Discourse Magazine about Elon Musk.
Oh yeah, okay.
You seem to have a mixed view of him, and we're looking for heroes these days.
Well, yeah, I know we're looking for heroes, but we're also frequently disappointed, especially when it comes to people who get involved in politics. Trust no one. So yeah, my view of Elon Musk is I've always regarded him as this frustratingly, curiously mixed person. Now, part of this, I think I've said this before, part of this comes from my background that for a while I was writing editing a publication that was focused on emerging technology and what's new, what's happening, what about exploring Mars, what about electric cars, what about this, what about that? And of course, Elon Musk figured very prominently there, and he would get up every morning and make a pronouncement, and I had to decide, is this pronouncement bold and visionary, or is it complete flimflam? And it was always kind of a toss-up. Some of the stuff was bold and visionary, and some of it was complete flimflam, and he didn't always know ahead of time which was which. So I've always found him to be sort of an annoyingly mixed character. So I wrote an article in Discourse where I basically said he's an Ayn Rand hero as rewritten by Tom Wolfe. Now, for those who I assume Ayn Rand is familiar to this audience, but for those who don't remember Tom Wolfe, he was the journalist and novel turned novelist, late 20th century journalist turned novelist, and he had this emphasis on these sort of flamboyant characters who were over the top. And who were often obsessed with attention and with status and with having everybody pay attention to them. And that's kind of how I feel about Elon Musk, that he is a guy who has some really big legitimate accomplishments. I mean, SpaceX is amazing. I have a graph it. I think it's linked to in that piece that you could click on it there, but there's a graph somebody put together of basically, the cost of putting a kilogram of payload into space, into Earth orbit over time. And you see it go dramatically down in the last 10, 15 years. And it's mostly because of SpaceX that's doing that. So, some huge legitimate accomplishments. At the same time, he's got some stuff that's complete flimflam. I think most of his Neuralink stuff, where he's going to put implants in your brain, that is highly dubious. And it's unlikely to really produce any results. A lot of his solar stuff didn't really hasn't really produced results. Like the solar roof tiles have kind of they were announced with great fanfare, then promptly disappeared for like a half dozen reasons I could give you. And Tesla itself is like, well, it's an electric car, but it's a lot of people are producing electric cars and it's kind of expensive. I actually did a calculation once that if you bought a really nice BMW luxury car and paid for all the gasoline for the life of the car, you would still not pay as much as you pay for a Tesla. So, it's kind of an iffy proposition as far as I'm concerned, how much that makes sense. So again, he's sort of has that characteristic of an Ayn Rand hero of the bold visionary who goes out and boldly defies expectations to create new things. And sometimes that's totally legitimate, and sometimes it's kind of a triumph of PR over reality. So that's why I find him a very frustrating character. That's why I said an Ayn Rand hero by way of Tom Wolfe.
I think the thing that triggered me was Carnival Barker. And I think, because in some ways, Edison and Tesla, from what I understand, they were kind of that way in promoting electricity as a new thing.
Well, I use Carnival Barker to refer to Tom Wolfe, and I explain it. I linked to an article I wrote when Tom Wolfe died. I did a little sort of a retrospective on him, And I called him America's Carnival Barker. And I said, well, it's not entirely in a bad way. It was, you know, he's a colorful guide. He's an entertaining guide to a colorful spectacle, right? And that's a good thing in a way, but it also has, again, it has that mixed character that it's a bad thing because sometimes he's also overhyping something.
That's fair. We want to encourage people to share the room as well as raise your hand if you want to get in on the questions. We also have a ton of questions. I won't spend the whole time on my questions. Sonia.
I should also let you know, Scott, that I just finished today drafting a draft of an article on the lessons of the debacle in Sri Lanka. So that might be, if anybody's interested in that, bring that up. It's all fresh in my mind.
You know what? Then I'll go ahead and switch because there are questions about that. It says, one is foolish politicians, socialist politicians destroyed Sri Lanka. The current situation is so dangerous. How can Sri Lanka achieve economic well-being and avoid bankruptcy?
That's the whole question. I'm not sure they are going to. They are bankrupt, essentially. They're not going to avoid bankruptcy. They're there. Now, here's the thing about that, though. So somebody said socialist politicians. Well, it's more environmentalist. But here's the thing about the article that as I went in looking into this, here's what I found. On the one hand, yes, this is absolutely a story of environmentalist utopia gone amok, right? So they pursued this idea of they actually banned by like executive decree, they banned the importation of fertilizers, of synthetic fertilizers, man-made artificial fertilizers and pesticides and things like that. And they basically did this immediate crash course forced national experiment in organic farming. And of course, it ended up being a total disaster and yields collapsed, agriculture yields collapsed. And it's still an economy that's highly dependent on agriculture, especially after, you know, the COVID pandemic led to a collapse in tourism. They got about $5 and $6 billion a year from tourism. That collapsed to about $1 billion a year. So they suddenly lost $5 billion a year, especially $5 billion a year in foreign exchange, you know, in foreign currency that was coming into the economy that they were using to buy things that they needed to import. And so on top of that, they then said, oh, but now we're going to take our other major part of our economy, the agricultural economy. Tea is especially important as an export business. If you ever had Ceylon tea, Ceylon is the original name for Sri Lanka, is the British colonial name for Sri Lanka. So they collapsed their tea production. They collapsed their rice production, et cetera. And they ended up having this just economic disaster and making a bad situation from COVID-19, making it even worse. By the way, I was recently on vacation in Europe. And so I had this experience where I was talking to one of the tour guides and he says, well, we'll know it's okay when the Japanese come back. So apparently the Japanese are the most cautious travelers. They're the last ones to stay away if there's a pandemic or anything like that. So he says, when the Japanese come back, we'll know we're totally out of this. Apparently it hasn't happened yet. So, you know, Sri Lanka had this, you know, in addition to COVID-19, they had this agricultural disaster, totally collapsed the country's economy, inflation out of control, people literally starving. It's a disaster. And so they overthrew their president. Now, here's the thing, though. And looking at this, the other part of this that is a cautionary tale is it's not just about environmentalism, because this ban on fertilizers was imposed by executive decree by a strongman ruler. And in fact, he's Rajapaksa is the name of the family. So he's Gotha something rather. Rajapaksa, it was the president. Mahinda Rajapaksa, his brother, was the previous president, and it was Basil Rajapaksa, another brother of his, who was considered to be the actual power behind the throne, who was responsible for all these, you know, really terrible economic policies. So it turns out what you actually had also as part of this story is it's a cautionary tale about authoritarianism and strongman rule. that you had this one single family. You know, it's a prominent family in Sri Lanka. They've been involved in the government since, you know, literally since the British were in charge of Sri Lanka. So they've got a long history there, a very prominent family. But basically, they filled the government full of his brothers and cousins and various family members, and tried to turn it into this like personal fiefdom of this one prominent family. And it was a nationalist and a religious nationalist sort of authoritarian system that they were working on creating. They had a 20th Amendment to the Sri Lankan Constitution that they passed a few years back, a couple years ago, that basically gave extra power to the executive, gave them the ability to appoint people without the advice and consent of the legislature. You know, they had a system similar to the British or American system before that, where if the president wanted to appoint somebody to a cabinet position or a prominent government position, he had to go get the approval of the legislature. Well, they got rid of that, and basically it meant so he could appoint all of his family members to every prominent key position. So it's also, as I see it, it's also a cautionary tale about authoritarian strongman rule, and especially the appeal of religious traditionalism and authoritarianism and nationalism. So it's sort of like a lot of the people on the right here in America are sort of grabbing on this. This is a cautionary tale about the policies of the left, and that's absolutely true. I would also say it's a cautionary tale about religious nationalism and the sort of strongman politics that has a certain currency today on the right.
Interesting. Lawrence, thank you for joining us. Do you have a question for Rob? I don't know if you're able to he's leaving and coming back. See if you can unmute now.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So, Rob, on along the same skew of Sri Lanka, what are your thoughts on the situation with the farmers in the Netherlands and sort of in multiple places happening in Europe now?
Yeah, I haven't been following. So I'm still sort of getting on top of everything after being gone for a while. I haven't followed what's going on in the Netherlands very closely, but I gather it's a similar thing, though not anywhere near as extreme. Partly because, you know, it's the Netherlands, they're not an extreme people. And also because they don't have an authoritarian, in Sri Lanka, because you have this sort of quasi-authoritarian system, you have, like, basically one guy, one of the Rajapaksa brothers, just gave an executive decree and banned all fertilizers and basically reversed the Green Revolution and totally altered the entire economy of the country overnight with no warning. You can't quite do that in the Netherlands. It's a freer society. It is there's more procedure and process. So it's not going to be as extreme a case. But it was, again, a case where there were various environmental restrictions being imposed on farmers and they're rebelling against it. It's something that happens quite frequently in Europe. It's one of the basic problems they have there, in that they have this consensus in Europe for this a very highly regulated a very strong government with lots of centralized regulation. But at the same time, you have the consequences of all those regulations. And you still have sort of ordinary people, blue collar workers and especially the farmers, who are left to bear the brunt of that. And because they have these highly centralized sort of technocratic systems. In France, I know that's the case. I'm assuming that's the case to some extent in the Netherlands, where there's not a lot of populist, they're kind of insulated from populist sentiment to a certain extent. So they tend to have this thing where they don't have the correcting mechanisms. When they go too far and do something that really impacts farmers, they don't really notice it until the farmers go up and, you know, start like making barricades and burning tires in the middle of the street. I'm not sure if there are burning tires in the Netherlands, but it was something similar to that. I know the French like to burn tires. They put tractor tires out there and set fire to them and barricade the streets. So they tend to have these occasional sort of rebellions against this overweening regulatory state that often has negative impacts on the ordinary person, and especially on farmers. I mean, farmers are always extremely vulnerable to this sort of thing because, you know, they're operating often on very, very tight margins and very dependent on the weather. And there's not a lot of big safety net for a farmer. So they often experience this sort of thing first before anybody else. But it comes from the fact that you have these highly productive, highly advanced societies that want to embrace policies that are, you know, inimical to being a highly advanced, highly productive, wealthy society. So they're always going to be experiencing this conflict in Europe.
Great. Thank you for that. Mr. Rembrandt, welcome.
Mr. Rembrandt.
Hey, okay. Yes, I'm here. Yeah, so I have a question. I promise I won't get too long-winded because I've done that before and Jennifer was like, okay, you know, and I appreciate that. But I'll ask my question. And my question is, I've been doing a lot of research into the study of the mind of socialism. And one particular thing that I'll ask you a question on is particularly when it comes to Todd Ross, who's a cognitive psychologist who studied tribalism. One of the things he studied is that people feel negative emotion when you tell them that they're having answers or ideas that are not divulged to the group that they identify with. So according to you or your opinion, do you believe that socialism is a very much ideological based belief rather than people actually believing that in the framework that, you know, denigrating to the type of philosophies they have are beneficial or actually work or scientifically beneficial rather than just an ideological premise?
Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting question. It happens by coincidence. I was just recently starting to reread The Road to Serfdom by Friedrich Hayek. And I'm reading the introduction, and he talks about how this is the introduction he wrote about 10 years after it came out, and talking about its reception, and talking about how, you know, he actually meant it when he wrote in the introduction. He dedicated the book to, he said, the book is dedicated to socialists of all parties. He says, and I really meant that. I think that these people were sincerely wanted what was best. They just had a wrong idea about how to achieve that, about what the best way was to go about it. And they hadn't thought through some of the consequences of pursuing socialist policies. And I think to some extent, early on in the history of socialism, that's true, that people come in because they are convinced philosophically in the virtue of the system. They're taken in by sort of sophistical arguments in favor of socialism. And they actually think, yes, this is totally going to work. And then there's a period, inevitably there's a period of disillusionment. And oftentimes, you know, many people who turn to the right and become opponents of socialism are people who were once, you know, idealistically committed to socialism. They really thought it was going to work, and then they observe the results, and then they turn against it. That, you know, that really happens. That's a real, you know, that I don't want to denigrate that. That's a real thing. By the way, can you guys hear me? Because I just got a warning about my connection.
Yeah, no, you sound okay. All right.
Yeah, you sound good.
I went talking for like 10 minutes on one of these things once and realized that nobody could hear me. So when in doubt, I like to check. All right, so there are definitely people who are philosophically convinced of this, or at least who are philosophically naive enough to be taken in by bogus arguments, right? They're not thinking, they're not challenging the arguments too clearly. They, you know, all sounds nice and vague in theory, especially when they're young and they don't, you know, when you're young, you often don't have a lot of experience of the world, don't have a lot of knowledge. You don't have the wherewithal to think this through and realize what's wrong with it. But I think the persistence of socialism has to do with that effect of tribalism, that it becomes a tribal identity. And I would say, though, it's not primarily socialism as a tribal identity that does it. I think, you know, that's a big impact. And we can see that, I think, much more visibly these days because, of course, you can go online to Twitter and you can watch people building and enforcing and expressing these tribal identities that we're the good people because we believe in socialism or we believe in big government or we believe in, you know, environmentalism or whatever. We're the good guys. We're the good people because of that. And all the people who disagree with, they're bad, evil people. And you can see people reinforcing those assumptions in their minds constantly, you know, oftentimes frantically on Twitter. And that's the tribalism at work. But I would also say that it's not primarily, that sense of identity is not primarily about socialism. I think it's primarily about altruism. The big appeal of socialism to people is not that they are become personally deeply committed to very abstruse ideas about economics. The appeal of it is it tells you that we could design a society around altruism. We could design a society around each according to his ability, you know, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. We could have design a society in which self-interest does not exist. It's been legislated, it's been programmed out of existence. Nobody acts on self-interest or profit anymore. Everybody acts on altruism. And wouldn't society be beautiful? So it really comes to the fact that people are raised with a commitment. And this is people from all backgrounds, not just people who are, you know, whose parents are on the left. People are raised with a commitment to altruism as a moral ideal. The idea that sacrificing yourself for others, renouncing self-interest is the root of all evil, that's drummed into them. And it's true whether you're a Christian or a socialist or even a conservative or whatever else. It's drummed into people. And because of that basic commitment, that sort of defines, I mean, the greatest trick that ever occurred is altruism became basically synonymous with morality. Right, to be altruistic is to be good, is to be moral. And you know, this was never true in the whole history of philosophy. There were all sorts of different philosophies that embraced self-interest to some extent. Altruism as the idea that self-interest as such is evil was a very late invention in the history of philosophy. It really comes, you know, it comes, I think, I argue, out of Kant and then reaches its explicit statement in the early 19th century. And Auguste Comte is the guy who coined the term altruism. But this idea of a philosophy of total self-abnegation, of total renunciation of the self, is actually sort of the minority view, or at least not by no means the dominant view in philosophy up until the 19th century. And then by the end of the 19th century, as it comes to America, as it gets widely accepted, it basically becomes synonymous in most people's minds with morality itself. To be a good person, you must be an altruist. To be a bad person is defined by selfishness, by self-interest. And that becomes so deeply ingrained that it cuts across all ideological and religious viewpoints. It is so widespread, and that's what people can't bring themselves to challenge. And I think that's the reason why socialism has its appeal, is it tells people, look, this thing you've been taught, that self-interest is the ultimate evil, self-sacrifice, sacrificing yourself, working only for the good of others is the moral ideal. We can make that work. We have a whole system we can implement that's going to implement that as a whole social system. Everything will work that way. And to be a good person, therefore, you must adopt this system. You must champion and advocate this system. And I think that's the fundamental reason why people have so dogmatically committed to socialism and can't bring themselves to challenge it.
Good. Yeah. And I think part of it is they're telling people that those who own property and want property are the ones stopping this nirvana from happening.
The funny thing about socialism, especially American socialism, is everybody, you know, if you were most places, I think most people who've been to college have had some experience of the trust fund socialist, right? The kid who has more money than you and is way more committed to socialism. The kid who's a property owner, essentially, probably inherit, you know, I knew guys who like had rental properties they inherited from their parent that were given by their parents. I mean, like, you know, they were capitalists, they were property owners, they were capitalist running dogs. And it's almost like to compensate for that, they had to become even more fanatical in their advocacy of socialism. So that's the thing about it, because they're so committed to this altruist thing, it doesn't really matter what your own status is in the economy, whether you're a proletarian or a capitalist, or whether you're proletarian or bourgeoisie, that doesn't matter. You have to be a socialist because it reflects your commitment to this altruist ideal.
Good. Thank you, Daniel. Thanks for joining us. Are you able to unmute? If not, you may need to quickly leave and come back.
I am sorry. It's away from my device, and I can hear you on the other side of the room. Thank you
very okay.
much. Thanks, sir. So sorry for the drama. So great room. Really interesting conversation. Such a great distinction that you just made about, you know, the altruistic value that people associate with the, you know, the attainment of an outcome that used to be not really in question whether you were left or right. You know, it used to be achieving progress in a conservative way is what a conservative would be. And we've, you know, evolved our societies from the point of villages onto what we have now with some balance of those points of view. And now they are weaponized, obviously, to state the obvious. And I guess the question that I am looking at, I mean, today, the UN Secretary General stated that humanity is on a suicide course where half the world is already in major threat, half the world right now. And
for,
I guess,
what,
an economist, as an economist, just let me finish to the question, if it's okay to, you know, set up for you to address. If that's true, and I would agree, not everybody agrees, right? But if it's true, and potentially as an engineering project, maybe human infrastructure, right? By 2050, it's also predicted we might have 1 billion refugees. So let's be clear, that's people without a home or a passport in most cases floating around the earth. So my question to you as an economist is, what do we do about that? That's not going to happen at a government. We could agree it's not going to get its act together in time for that. So my question is really, are we just going to sit and let it happen? Or does economics begin to figure out how to survive? That's my question.
All right. So first of all, are you asking me as an economist? Because I'm not an economist.
Oh, I do.
I'm a guy with knowledge.
Sorry. So we're having an economics and justice and thought process conversation about the issues.
Now, the second thing is, it was a little unclear to me, what is the particular world-ending crisis that we're talking about at this particular point?
Got to be the climate.
Yeah, we're living in an existential crisis right now. We're already living in climate change already right now as an entire planet. Some of us aren't feeling it yet. Some of us are.
That's a highly debatable assumption, actually, because, and in fact, if you look at the data, see, I've looked at this. So if you look at the data, we are below the low end of all predictions of global warming catastrophe. And we're actually more or less within the range of natural variation that has always occurred. Now, there are some places where variations are occurring in localized ways. So, for example, in California, it's very dry recently. Now, I looked into this a while back and I found out, they're saying, oh, it's droughts, it's because of climate change. Well, if you look at it, and they've done projections and measurements of looking at, you know, what do we think was the amount of water available in California over the last couple of the last 1,000 years, essentially. And what they found is that actually the early 20th century was an unusually wet period for California, unusually high rainfall. And they're basically just gone back to the norm of being a dry desert, you know, semi-arid desert region, practically a desert region. And the problem, of course, is then 50 million people moved in and tried to live there in the meantime. And, you know, that's why they have shortages of water. So it's not some unprecedented thing that's happened with the climate.
And just to save time, so you and I are not on the same page that there's actually a crisis at all.
Absolutely not.
Let's start with what we might agree on. Have you had occasion to, just so I know if you and I have it as common reference, to see the IPCC report on climate change at all?
I've perused the results of several of them. The whole report's 1,000.
But I was just speaking specifically about this particular one, the IPCC.
I saw the IPCC Climate Gate report where they talked about going after scientists that questioned the official narrative.
Scott, let's not go on to that. We will talk about
talking about the documentation as to whether it's in common. It's obviously not from what it sounds like. That's okay. I'm going to look at it this way as an entrepreneur, because I'm not a socialist, right? I think that there's a human infrastructure project that's not being paid for, that there's a great private opportunity. whether you agree on how severe or not severe at all, or what the causes are. I think we wasted 35 years talking about who caused climate change. It's never, ever been a question about what are we going to do about it, because I definitely don't think governments are going to do anything about it. And what the IPCC report says, so if you think they're overestimating, let's put this in context. Their statement is that by 2050, a billion people will be homeless and without a passport. They have many thousands of scientists across seven disciplines and reporting from all parts of the globe before they come to that conclusion. But whatever, whether you want to dismiss it or not, let's say that they're wrong by 90%. Let's say it's only 100 million people. Well, 100 million people is 100 times the Syrian crisis. And look what that did to destabilize the world. So to think that you don't have an opportunity to create a lifestyle for those people, maybe 3D print something that lives on water that can create its own food. You don't have to look at everything from a crisis standpoint. You can also look at it in a place we can agree on. Let's make some money from it. Let's make some capital for it. Let's actually generate capital for it.
If you want to make money on it, go ahead and risk your own capital on it. I would not risk my capital on it because I think those projections are so inherently uncertain. And by the way, you say thousands of scientists. Well, thousands of scientists did not produce that conclusion about refugees. That's based on a couple of projections from a couple of people. A lot of the science. No, I just happened to.
How would you know that if you hadn't read it? With all respect, I'd agree with you if you'd read it.
No. That I know. I know how the IPCC system works. There are thousands of scientists who are cited. Most of them are cited for their work on one particular little area. Now, the other little dirty little secret of the IPCC process is that what most people see is the policymaker summary, which is usually written by people who are in the political end of the process and not by scientists. And it generally tends to over-exaggerate what's in the actual content of the report and make it sound more dire because it's supposed to be the thing that motivates politicians to act.
And right, so if other people looked at the same
report,
data,
the body of the report itself is more right. Cautious.
So if other people read the same data, they would have a different conclusion, and the political bent by the summarizers basically are preventing people from seeing what's really there. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not saying no. In this case, it wouldn't be preventing people from seeing what's really there because it's a projection, right? There's nothing that's really there. It's a bunch of people trying to project what the consequences might be of some future development if it happens, mm-hmm. which is so inherently uncertain. I think that especially on something like refugees,
even when I would apply like 90% moderation to their published statistic and say it's only 100 million people, do you understand like how destabilizing to the world that is? If it turns
actually,
out
actually okay, so here's the other thing: that why don't we have 100 million people destabilized now? There's certainly no shortage of chaos in the world, right? Now we do have a lot of refugees in the world, and what we do, what we should do in response to, if there are millions of refugees, I think we should find a way to take those people in. Now, usually in this case, they're from wars and various wars and chaos.
Ability to build them real estate, and lots of other people like me are willing to do it too, without having to, you know, sort of wait.
What we have is insane immigration laws that prevent us from taking any of those people in. And, you know, giving them a new life as productive members of our society.
But let them finish.
So this idea that, we're going to build habitats for them on the water, it's an extremely complicated solution where there's a very easy solution, which is let them settle in Turkey. Or, you know, that's what a whole bunch of people from Syria have settled in Turkey. Or let them settle in, bring in hundreds of thousands of refugees from the war in Ukraine, let them come to Chicago. That's what they used to do. You know, all the Ukrainians came to New York and Chicago. So we're trying, part of I think is there's a tendency to find extremely complicated solutions when there are very easy ones. But then again, I also say projections of, I've lived long enough to know, projections of what's going to happen in 2050 are universally almost worthless. That's my prior coming into this. And it's based on long years of experience of seeing. Oh, so here's a great example of that. I just saw Jim Pethakoukas, who has a newsletter that I read, talked about if everybody remember what the Club of Rome was, these are the guys who wrote back in 1972, they wrote this very influential book called The Limits to Growth. warning that in, you know, by the end of the century, we're going to run out of this and we're going to run out of that and we're going to have all these shortages. People will be starving. The entire economy will be collapsing because we're going to run out of oil and all these other natural resources. Well, apparently, a bunch of these people have put out a book 50 years later. A bunch of people, I'm sure not all the same people, but people following in that tradition, put out another book 50 years later, claiming they were never really wrong about anything. But of course, they were all completely wrong about everything. You know, that the resource shortages that they claimed that they were projecting 50 years ago, none of that ever actually happened. None of that materialized. So one of the things I want to warn you to is the world is full of predictions of stuff that's going to happen 30 years from now. And my bias against all those predictions, no matter how many people you have sign on to it, is that most of them are going to be completely wrong, because that's the track record of all such predictions. The future is very hard to predict, and especially predictions of doomsday and catastrophe have a real tendency to go wrong. So another thing I've been doing recently is I just caught up on the new Star Trek series, Strange New Worlds. And anybody wants to ask me about that, I got many things to say about it. I'll restrain myself at the moment. But one of the things that always amuses me about the Star Trek universe is their history of the past, their history of here's what happened to America and to the Earth, you know, in previous centuries. It always has to keep getting updated because we were all supposed to be like engulfed in eugenics war and nuclear war and catastrophe and global collapse. That was all supposed to happen like sometime 20 years ago. In the original timeline of the Star Trek series. Now, Star Trek has a reputation for being this optimistic view of the future, but it was always an extremely pessimistic view of the immediate future, that the late 20th century was going to be collapse and warfare and destruction. And they're still doing that, except they've updated it too well. It happens in the early to mid 21st century. So basically, it happens 5 years from now, essentially. And that's what they're doing in the new series. The apocalypse is going to happen, but it's going to happen sometime in the 2020s or the 2030s. And so that's what I want to point out, that the projections of pessimism and collapse and destruction from the left and the right have an extremely long history, track record of being wrong. And part of it is that people exaggerate certain threats because those threats fit with their priors. They fit with their ideological assumptions. So if your assumption is anti-industrial, if you think the Industrial Revolution was a bad idea, that capitalism is a bad idea, you have this great incentive to say, well, therefore, capitalism is actually destroying the world. It's going to lead to a billion refugees and the temperatures are going to go out of control, etc. And, you know, if you're on the right, you're going to say, oh, wokeism is destroying the world and we're causing the collapse of the West. And you're going to exaggerate that threat as well. So people, partisans who have an axe to grind, have a strong incentive to exaggerate threats and overhype them. And then the second thing is they also have an incentive to ignore various things that we will do to mitigate the effects of those threats. Now, one of the things with regard to global warming is if we don't do anything about global warming, and we probably won't, and we don't do the things they're asking us to. First of all, I don't think it's at all certain global warming is going to happen. Further warming is going to happen if that is the case. But if we don't do anything, one of the things that we know will happen is the economy will keep growing for another 30 years. More people will be raised up out of extreme poverty. They'll have far more resources at their disposal to use to deal with whatever consequences come. So I actually think these dire projections of all these refugees we're going to have are not taking into account that, you know, barring political interference like the kinds we saw, you know, I was just talking about Sri Lanka, barring, you know, politically caused disasters like that, you're going to have a whole bunch of people who are way better off, way wealthier, way more technologically advanced than they are today or than they ever have been in all of human history. And so I think you're actually going to be way more capable of dealing with any disruptions from the weather, any problems, any problems that the climate may or may not produce. So I would actually predict you're going to see far fewer refugees if we have continued economic growth and we don't shut down the entire economy to deal with what I think is a dubious threat.
Good stuff. Thank you for that, Rob. We want to get Clark in here. Clark, thanks for joining us. Clark, are you able to oh, good.
By the way, yes, I'm not sure I convinced Daniel on any of that, but we could maybe circle back later if we have time.
Yes. Rob, thanks so much for your great presentation as usual. But I would like to ask you what I ask all the Atlas Society scholars. If we do have a big recession, maybe even depression-sized recession within the next year or so, and, you know, this is, we've had it really good. We've been in the boom, obviously, of the country, the U.S. We've had all this easy money, you know, in memory for at least the last decade. And people are angry as hell at each other. Well, what happens, Rob, when suddenly we have to, you know, they take the punch bowl, the proverbial punch bowl is taken away, and things get really bad. What is your take on that, politically, economically, culturally, socially?
Oh, we've been through it before. We had it, you might have recalled, we had a little bit of a financial crisis in 2008, 2009. And I felt that more acutely because my wife's an architect. So the collapse of the of new housing construction had an impact here. So we've been through that before. We've had a recession in around 2001. We had the war on terror. We had New York attacked. I mean, that had a big impact. Anybody remember the Enron thing? We have these occasional recessions every 10 years or so. And I think we're going to make it through. I think that 99% of cataclysmic scenarios do not come to pass. And it's really easy to overhype them because you want to think, oh, you know, the current people in charge, whether it's Joe Biden or whatever, they're so bad. This is definitely going to lead to this massive depression. Well, probably not. I actually see signs of inflation peaking out. I think we're going to, we're going to probably, you know, if you ask me to project, and of course, you know, part of my theme here is predictions are hard, especially about the future, right? So I'm not going to say, oh, I absolutely know what's going to happen. But, you know, based on past experience, more than likely the result is things will get a little bad and then we'll muddle through. And we'll have a period of really sucky low growth. And then we'll come back to sort of slightly higher growth, not too great. Maybe we'll have a little boom for a couple of years if we get another Ronald Reagan, although I don't see any Ronald Reagan waiting in the wings to help us out here. The biggest economic growth I had in my lifetime was for a couple of years in the early 80s. We had 5 to 7% growth continuously for a whole period there as the dividend of Reaganomics. If we get another Reagan, we'll have that. I doubt we're going to get another Reagan. I think we're going to muddle through with this sort of Clinton, Bush, Obama kind of economy we've had for the last 30 years. I think if you have a major economic catastrophe, yes, there could be greater upheaval. I think that what I see is a lot of people basically trying to create the upheaval as if we had a cataclysm right now, trying to create it before we have the cataclysm in anticipation, because there's some aspect of the existing system they don't like, and they'd like there to be a revolution, right? So I hear a lot of sort of Trump-type people, sort of wishing for an economic collapse, because then maybe we could have that American Civil War that they want, where we finally have it out with the woke people and we all shoot each other. There's a certain faction on the right that sort of fantasizes about that. And I'm sure there are people on the left, I know there are people on the left, who are also wishing maybe we'll have the final collapse that will show that capitalism doesn't work, and then we can herd everybody into the socialist utopia. They've always been wanting that to happen. There's always been a faction out there wanting and waiting and expecting that to happen. And it just keeps not happening. So, I think what we have to do is we're going to have to muddle. We're going to go through this long period of muddling through, in which we are going to have to do, instead of having some cataclysm solve the problem or produce the result for us, we're going to have to actually think about, okay, what kind of society we want to live in? What principles do we want to be based on? We're going to have to think through those basic issues and actually make a choice about how we're going to solve those problems and not have the solution foisted upon us by some outside crisis.
I hope you're right.
good stuff. You probably don't want the question about whether Bitcoin's going back to 50,000 then.
What is Bitcoin right now? I don't really know what it is. Right
it, now. It's it went down to like 18,000. Now it's back up to 23.
I have no idea what Bitcoin's going to be worth because I have no idea why it's worth anything at all. So that's my thought on that.
All right. Exactly. I'll mark that as answered. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Yeah, I had a question, but before I ask it, I just want to say, if the apocalypse is not coming, I find that kind of disheartening because I figure the sooner we get to that dystopian future, the sooner Zefren Cochrane will invent warp drive and we can usher in the age of Star Trek. But that's just
awesome. Me. Awesome. Awesome response. I like that.
Yeah, that's just me. But
see, my take on it, though, is if we don't have the apocalypse, then we have no excuse not to get warp drive earlier.
That's true. That's true.
Right? If Zefren Cochrane could do it while the whole world was collapsing and in civil war, why can't we do it now in peacetime without with all the advantages we have? So that's my rant. On
well, that we could get into a whole philosophical discussion about human nature, but let's not do that. But related to human nature, I think it was you switching to education. I think it was you who said once a while back that there were a group of African-American parents who moved to an affluent area, and when they did, they expected their kids' grades to go up, and when they didn't, a bunch of people studied it and trying to find the reason, and the reason turned out was that that in those affluent areas, parents were more involved in their children's education.
Yes.
And that's why. And you didn't give a link or a reference to that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had that because.
Oh, God. I can't get it now. It's in the New York Times. It was a New York Times article from 10 years ago, I'm thinking.
Oh, jeez.
I looked for
it and I couldn't find it. So if you happen to run across it, that's my only question. Please send me the link.
Send me your email. You can find me on Twitter or wherever. On Twitter or go to my website, you can probably find a contact thing. Send me your email. It's possible. It's very likely that I linked to that article somewhere in my newsletter at one point, and that might be an easier way to find it than just sort of searching at random. In the New York archives.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because, I mean, I can just say that as a quick side story, my son was the third grade spelling bee champion. Yes, I'm bragging. And that has as much to do with the fact that maybe he might have been smart, but also that from kindergarten on, I used to make him write out each word he got. You know, they'd get 20 words a week. Write it out and say it as he was writing it. And that I attribute it to that more than anything else. So that's my parental involvement story.
Well, and that's the thing I like to tell people is that people get despondent about the state of education. And I like to tell them that, yes, you should be very concerned about what kind of schools your kids are in. I cannot properly afford to send my kids to a private school. I do it anyway because I like the schools I'm sending to them are way better than sending them to public school. But in addition to that, though, the biggest impact you have on your kids is what kind of home environment they have and what kind of life they have with you. And, you know, hate to say it, but in Montessori school, they have this phrase, modeling good behavior, you know, that the kids learn by watching you. And you model certain behaviors and they tend to view that as normal and as something to be emulated and imitated. And so the environment you raise them in has a huge impact. And that's kind of a positive, optimistic thing is that no matter what the state of the culture is, your kids are likely to actually end up in pretty good shape so long as you are in good shape, you know, and so as long as you're providing a good environment for them and a good example, it gives them a huge advantage.
Yeah, I agree. So thanks.
And that's also, by the way, the place you should look to for that is it's a point made repeatedly by Charles Murray, who talks about how you have this sort of the woke establishment. It consists of educated upper middle class people who live a certain lifestyle that is a very traditional lifestyle. They tend to get married and stay married. They tend to not have, they tend to get educated first and then have children. They tend to, you know, work hard and regard work as important. They tend to engage in all these things that are, you know, like hidebound conservative life advice, right? They tend to live according to that creed while considering it to be absolutely blasphemous for many to say that those are good things to do, that you should, you know, that you should stay married, that you should wait to have kids, that, you know, single motherhood is not ideal. All these things are blasphemous for them to actually say. So they live on one code, but then they don't allow anybody to advocate that as an ideal. And he talks about how, you know, what this produces is this disconnect where people who tend to be poorer and less well off are tend not to have, you know, so people who are the educated upper middle class tend to have and to spread to their kids a set of values that they won't advocate for anybody else. They will actually attack you for advocating it for anybody else. And so they sort of perpetuate their own privilege through their own kids, while denying it to people who are less well off. So that's a point that Charles Murray has made that I think is a worthwhile one.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I actually saw on social media one time, they said being too involved in your kid's education is a manifestation of privilege.
Oh, there was an Australian ABC reporter, it's an Australian broadcasting company, of some Australian philosopher saying that reading to your kids is a perpetuation of privilege. And so it's like, well, too bad, because I'm scheming to give my kids as much privilege as I can possibly give them. And I'm very well aware that I have been the recipient of that kind of quote-unquote privilege from the previous generations that came before me, that my people came from much poorer, less educated backgrounds, and they worked like hell to make sure that I had these advantages. I'm going to give even more advantages to my kids. That's how the system is supposed to work. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just privilege to them means something akin to original sin.
Yes, exactly.
JP, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, Rob. I would like to ask you something personally. Sure. Are you wary of the state right now? Is it out of control already? Has it failed us, or has it benefited us in the current nation state form? Are we ripe for something new?
And, well, what do you mean by something new other than the nation state? What's your alternative to the nation state?
Some
world
form
government
of,
or no government? Which direction are you going?
A monarchic government, yeah. A monarchic government for security. And
well, you're talking about an anarchic government.
Minarchic, so minimal.
Minarchic, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so small government is what you're saying, minarchy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the state always fails us. I mean, that's one of the great lessons of history, right? The state is always out of control or on the verge of being out of control, and it is always failing us. Now, it doesn't mean that, like I said, I try to argue against the apocalypse every time people bring it up, because we actually have been in much worse conditions. Or other people have been in much worse conditions than we are in right now. So what I'd say is that the normal condition is that always, everywhere, in some respect, the state is failing us, because that's, you know, controlling the world through the use of force is always going to be a losing proposition. And even when you're trying to do it even a government that's doing only the things it's supposed to be doing, like the police, courts, and the military, the police are still going to screw up. The military is still, yeah. Everyone I know who's been in the military has always said, you know, there's a reason they say, you know, snafu, situation normal, all messed up, right?
For sure.
This is the normal. Even the military, you know, the legitimate functions of government, basic legitimate functions of government, those are always screwed up too, because these are inherently difficult things to do, and they're inherently prone to abuse of power or corruption or inefficiency or incompetence, etc. Right? So the state is always failing us. The state is always in danger of getting out of control. It's a matter of relative judgments. That sometimes the state's doing a better job than others. Sometimes the state is less dangerous or more, sometimes it's more dangerous, sometimes it's less dangerous. So you always have to put it on a sliding scale. Now, are people ready for something different? No, they're not ready for something different. They very much want to muddle through with what we have or with something that is 5 minutes either direction of what we have. By 5 minutes, I mean, you know, this is a saying that I have, that there's a tendency people have to, when things go wrong, to want to say, oh, well, that went badly. Let's go back to the way things were 5 minutes before it all fell apart, right? Because it was all doing fine then. And they don't realize that, well, the reason it all fell apart was something went wrong much earlier and we have to reform. Now, they want to go back to the last, very last moment before everything blew up, right? So that's the general tendency people have. And I see that a lot, that, you know, right now there's a lot of people on the left, for example, who are like, oh, this, you know, there are some people on the left, the sort of the Stephen Pinker types, the Jonathan Rauch and maybe Andrew Sullivan, who are like, oh, this political correctness has gotten out of control. You're right. The woke set is trying to silence us. We should go back to that ideal of free speech and tolerance and open-mindedness and pluralism, the 1990s. I was like, I was around in the 1990s. It wasn't that this great ideal. It was a way better environment for people like Stephen Pinker and Jonathan Rauch and Andrew Sullivan, because they were smack dab in the middle of the range of viewpoints that was widely tolerated, whereas people like me were not, okay? So, like I said, everybody has this idea, we're going to go back to the last moment at which things seem comfortable and be working well for me. So, no, I don't think people are ripe for something new. I think they're going to have to be very, ideally, you know, in the worst case scenario, well, the worst case scenario is we have a huge crisis. And the most likely response from a huge crisis is we respond to it by making things worse and we go into an even worse crisis. That, so think like Weimar Germany, right? They have hyperinflation and you have economic collapse and social upheaval. Everybody says, well, to deal with that, we should go elect, you know, the Nazis. And so you end up thinking you have a terrible problem and your response is to make things worse. The best thing, you know, the second least worst response is we have a giant crisis and people say, let's go the other direction. Let's go back towards a free society and smaller government. That I consider less likely than the other. The best case scenario is, like I said, we muddle through and eventually by arguing and convincing and by people seeing the results of some good, you know, some good policies being adopted and achieving good results, we slowly manage to turn the ship around and move it back towards a less intrusive government.
It is going to take a long, long, long time, right?
Right. And the thing is that if it gets slightly better in my lifetime, I'm happy. That's basically, I've adjusted my expectations.
Very nice. Well, that's probably a good note to end it. It was a good session. I like the way you held me back from the guy with the different views. So, lots of good stuff at the Atlas Society this week. Tomorrow at 5 p.m., Jennifer Grossman, our CEO, will be interviewing actor-director Robert Anthony Peters on across all channels, Zoom, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. And then Friday, back here on Clubhouse, Professor Jason Hill will be doing part two of Allegory, Propaganda, and Didacticism in the Novels of Ayn Rand. That's at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. The first part was very thought-provoking. In the meantime, I want to thank everyone that submitted questions and everyone who joined us live on stage. And, you know, if I'll just throw in my geeky Star Trek reference that, you know, who knew that Joan Collins could have helped Hitler win World War II?
That's a good one. I like that.
All right, great. Well, thanks everyone for joining us, and we hope to see you again next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.